Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
I first want to introduce Sandy Powell, who I met yesterday, and I told her I realized every time I see her, she's receiving an Academy Award, so we should probably give her one tonight. But she's been nominated 10 times for Oscars. She's won 3 times for Shakespeare in Love, The Aviator, and Young Victoria. Her other credits include The Crying Game, Velvet Goldmine, for Todd, The End of an Affair, also with Julianne Moore. And luckily, she has been collaborating with Martin Scorsese recently. She did the costumes for Gangs of New York, The Departed, The Aviator, Shutter Island, Hugo, and is working on the new film right now. So she's in New York, so please welcome Sandy Powell. And Mark Friedberg, who we did a master class with a few weeks ago, works for so many of the best directors, because they all know he's the most amazing production designer. He worked with Wes Anderson with the Darjeeling Limited and The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. He did Across the Universe with Julie Taymor, Pollock with Ed Harris, which we're featuring upstairs in the exhibition. For Ang Lee, he did The Ice Storm and Ride with the Devil. Broken Flowers for Jim Jarmusch, Synecdoche, New York. And he's working on Noah right now. Yes, the guy from the Bible. For Darren Aronofsky, and we are so pleased. He actually just came in from Iceland, where they're doing locations for Noah, and we're very pleased that he's with us. So please welcome Mark Friedberg. And it's very special for me to be able to introduce Todd Haynes, because he was here in 1988 when we showed Superstar, and that was a time when you could show Superstar in its glorious 16mm. And so it's been amazing to watch this career. He, of course, you know his credits: Poison, Safe, Velvet Goldmine, Far From Heaven, I'm Not There, Mildred Pierce, which has become our annual Mother's Day film. We show it every Mother's Day since we reopened here, and I hope we do it again. And that's also designed by Mark, an incredible piece of work. So we're thrilled that he's back with us today. Please welcome Todd Haynes. Sorry, okay. I took your seat. So I wanted to start. I'm going to read a quote from a book about Todd's films, I think by James Morrison is the name. But he writes, "This is why in Far From Heaven, the love and pain depicted is almost too big for any single character to contain. So it spills into the music, the wardrobe and decor, the colors and shadows on screen. The style allows expression to be spread into nonverbal arenas, displacing the desire and villainy of the characters onto literally the walls and the clothes that they inhabit." So, you know, I think that really captures a lot about the film, that it really is conceived in these visual terms. So could you talk, Todd, I guess, first about sort of how you conceived the film? I talked in the beginning a bit about these color diagrams that you made and drawings and artwork that you made to start your process.
This was a real extraordinary production full of amazing memories of working with these two extraordinary people, Annette Lachman and Elmer Bernstein, who did the score. And that's not even getting into the amazing actors in the story. And it was a labor of love, because it was my own humbling sort of tutorial looking at the great work of Douglas Sirk and some of the work of Max O'Fools that also felt relevant to the storytelling. And, you know, really paying homage to this pretty unique period of mid-century Hollywood studio filmmaking that really brought the whole tradition of the maternal melodrama, domestic melodrama, to a level of just technical brilliance and complexity, let alone dramatic complexity that's always sort of been part of, in my opinion, this genre. And the amazing thing about the genre and the thing that allows for the visual language to take and the oral language, melodrama means music and drama, literally, is that it's often about, and I think this is best epitomized in the best films of Douglas Sirk, that was definitely my inspiration. You know, it takes as its subjects really limited, ordinary people, not heroic people, people who you might call victims of their relative, their respective societies, who don't always have the wherewithal to handle the conflicts that they encounter in their lives. And the kinds of conflicts that they encounter in their lives are the kinds of conflicts that we all encounter in life. They're about family and love and loss and infidelity. But these are limited, these are people with limitations, again, like us. And so they can't always articulate what they are experiencing. And there's a, you know, there's articles about characters in melodrama that talk about them always being in a state of semi-astonishment about about the fates that they're encountering as they unfold. And you see this in you know, Jane Wyman or Lana Turner or some of the famous Sirk heroines. And but that limitation of being able to articulate and sort of master their problems means that it provides and makes necessary the whole cinematic language to fill in for those limitations. And so as opposed to often what we experience in movies where the meaning is quadrupled by verbiage, by heroic characters who are in control of the narrative trajectory, and then followed up with music and image, and you're like, yeah, I get it, I get it, I get it. This really leaves these spaces where music, color, decor, costume, gesture, camera have a role to play, and a necessary role, often sometimes to communicate things characters aren't capable of, and sometimes to contradict what they are saying and to create a kind of counter language. These decors are often claustrophobic and overwhelming and in some ways belittle the subjects themselves. So in all these ways, it calls upon the great traditions of cinematic visual, you know, that's probably my fault. Telling the car, making sure that we got here. Sorry. That's embarrassing. And, you know, it enables people like myself to bring people like these guys on board and make use of their amazing abilities.
So I'll... you know, hearing you talk about what you, you know, what the feelings were, what your intention was with the drama, I'll read one more quote. It's the last quote I have, but I wanted to do this because it's me quoting you, quoting Rainer Werner Fassbinder, quoting Douglas Sirk, which seems appropriate for this occasion. And the quote is, "You can't make films about things. You can only make films with things, with people, with light, with flowers, with mirrors, with blood." You know, meaning that everything you're talking about has to be physicalized. So right. I guess if you could talk about that process. So let's start maybe with this idea of your color scheme, because I understand that you had long conversations, the three of you, I guess, and Ed, about color and how you would approach each scene. So
Yeah. Well, it started with Sirk, who's known these mid-century masterpieces of his, Written on the Wind, All That Heaven Allows, The Magnificent Obsession, Imitation of Life, are known for their use of color and for a kind of also a use of often wider angle lenses that keep the focal range, keep deep focus and keep deep space in focus and create a kind of enamel-y, hard-edged kind of harshness almost to the color palette. And so this was an opportunity for us to make color such a sort of seminal part of our aesthetic discussion and the way that we really conceptualized these spaces that the characters inhabit, and the changes and the contradictory spaces. There's a lot of this film is about bound, very intensely zoned spaces that are transgressed or trespassed by the characters. And so, yeah, we got to. I started by writing the script, but then spending time with scenes and just using Pantone color swatches and creating kind of a color temperature. The thing I should say that's really beautiful about probably the seminal film we looked at was All That Heaven Allows from 1956. And in that case, unlike Written on the Wind, which has a kind of more stoplight primary color palette that's really in your face, pops at you, you know. All That Heaven Allows has this beautiful autumnal, but also, contradictory palette. What's the word? Complementary palette. Where you see elements of warm and cool in almost every frame of the film. And it kind of gives a kind of, you know, intuitive resonance to the conflicting emotions and the sort of unreconcilable conflicts that are told in the story, and so we really took that as a kind of liberty to talk about complementary colors and a mixing of temperature, emotional temperature, and narrative temperature, I guess. And so we started with these color swatches that were sort of almost designed scene by scene. But we spent, you know, at least, you know, a day, if not more, just days.
We actually translated the script into color.
Into wow. color.
There was a color version of the script. It was almost a scoring.
It was a scoring session. It was. It really was.
Yeah, and again, you can see these swatches upstairs. It's amazing. Yeah. Can Stanley talk, I guess, about how you, your sort of early discussions about this film? Because you had worked on the previous film, which was so different. Velvet Goldmine was just...
Okay. Subject matter was different, but I think the process was...
You're a popular guy, yeah.
Maybe it's you.
It's either... Yeah.
It's you. It is. It's the car company.
Okay.
Oh. Sorry.
So... Subject was different, but I think the working process was similar. I mean, we had long, intense meetings during Velvet Goldmine, and Far From Heaven started out in the same way. Mm. But I think the meetings I remember most are the ones with you, Mark, Ed. And it went on for days, actually. We had long weekends where I remember we looked through All That Heaven Allows scene by scene, right, as well as going through our script and with your Pantone colours.
Right.
And talked. And what I did with the colours, I sort of did a similar thing with the fabrics. I kind of bought lots of fabric swatches, mm-hmm, laid them out on a table, and I had them there. And I kind of, I think, used the word intuitive. And I think it was an intuitive decision as to which colours to use where, knowing what Todd's colour choices were. But it wasn't ever anything like, oh, I'm going to make the dress pink because that's the pink he's got in his swatch. It was, I don't know, it just sort of came together instinctively, in a way. I sort of worked in the same way with the colours just spread out on a table in front of me.
And what could you say about this process? What was it like?
Well, the part I loved the most about it was that, you know, I actually met Todd in fine art class in college, and that was, that, you know, so to work with a director who had such an understanding of what you can do with colour. And it wasn't just that this scene would be this colour and this would be that, but it was more that the costume might be doing this, and the wall might be doing that, but the light might be counteracting it,
right,
and all that. And that created a dynamic. And that's, you know, because the characters can never really say what they feel or feel what they say, it's the vibration between, inherently oppositional things that go together beautifully that kind of allowed them to... in a way, help them figure out what they were feeling, or to allow it out into the world that way. So, mm-hmm.
And how did you talk about the tone of the film? I mean, it's a film which at first, you know, maybe when you hear the idea of it, it seems like it's going to be sort of ironic or sort of postmodern in a way. And I guess more and more over time, I guess, as you revisit the film, you realize the emotional power of it, I think.
I mean, I just watched it a couple of days ago and expecting this to happen. I hadn't seen it in many years. I guess we just talked about, I found a director's statement because I had to go through all this old stuff for the exhibition, where I did say in some sort of a statement that was part of the script that I think you guys all got was, you know, that it was, you know, in the tradition, the great tradition of Cirque and so forth, but that I was self-conscious about doing it when we were doing it, and this was at the very beginning of George W. Bush's first year, it was before 9/11. In fact, 9/11 happened while we were in pre-production on Far From Heaven in New York, when we were actually driving to Ground Zero. We were driving to 80 Center Street.
Lower Manhattan.
Yep, and it occurred then, but that there was at least a mirroring or something about the sort of era of complacent consumerist, you know, culture that we were entering with Bush that felt relevant to the 50s in America, or at least something that there could be a dialogue between the two in this film. But that said, I think somewhere in that statement I said we would play this straight. Mm-hmm. You know, we would take these stylistic traditions with a great deal of love and care, and not be sort of above them, not be kind of, you know, that we would wear them. We would wear them. We would try to learn from them and emulate them as best as possible. Now, I knew at some level that was a tremendous risk, that these they were alienating at the time, I think, in ways. Melodrama has a way of kind of pushing you out and then secretly sort of sucking you back in at the same time. And this has been true, I think, for melodrama from the beginning, even in, you know, its origins in 19th century literature and European canons of literature, popular literature, because it was always there to kind of expose social contradictions and limitations, but it was also a popular art form, popular form, you know, mass form. So it had these sort of almost diametrically opposed instincts going on at the same time. And I think you feel that. You feel push me, pull you. You feel a contradiction in them, you know. And it's even why Fassbinder said they leave you feeling unsatisfied in an interesting way.
Either of you, Sandy and Mark, talk specifically about the sort of materials you were working with? You were using an interesting mix of locations, I guess, and sets. The train station is Yonkers, I reckon, which just never looks so good, that train station. But you know, so you found some great locations to work with, but also were building sets.
And the hard part and the exciting part was that you wanted the sets to look like sets. And so we were trying to make our locations feel like sets in ways. And that's part of Bush's America was the kind of artifice that we live in. And so both saying that we've made this isn't real, and at the same time, there's so much real that you're feeling because of that, you have to live this way.
Right.
And so that was, it took me a long time to try and figure out what that meant, to try and, you know, we spend so much time trying to make our sets look like they're real, and so that the characters can exist in them. And if you notice that they're sets, you've failed horribly, because the set is a background and it should be pushing the story forward and allowing it. And here, the set gets there about 10 minutes before the actor does. Sometimes and the colors are shiny and
exactly.
So it took me a little while to kind of understand that. Of course, I haven't quite gotten over it now, and it's like my, you know, favorite. I like it when the sets get there early. That was nice.
I just noticed the same thing with the costumes. Normally, when you make a costume for an actor, once you'd made it, you'd work on it to make it look like it'd been worn and look a bit old and look real. And I actually noticed in that, I thought, my God, everything looks brand new and crisp and fresh and bright, and it's not normally what I do. And I think it must have been the same thing. It's that sort of like everything's fresh off the press.
Yeah, we were shooting in autumn and still painting the leaves to make them more colorful.
Wow.
It was phenomenal.
And could you talk about the costumes for Julianne Moore's character? Because there's so many costume changes, and this is a character where you have to feel, you feel this inner life and depth to her that she can't quite express verbally. I mean, because she, all the characters in the film, I mean, it's one of the great things about the script. They're sort of limited in what they can express, but you know there's a lot going on. So a lot of this comes through in the costume for her, I think.
I only caught the last 15 minutes, and I wanted to watch it myself again because I haven't seen it for a while, so I actually can't remember a lot of them. I know she had a lot, and I guess, yeah, I mean, we sort of tell the story through the costumes without being as obvious, like it's, I wouldn't sort of give her a sad dress because she was feeling sad, but somehow you use the colour and the tone of what she's wearing to help convey the feeling of the entire scene, really, and what's going on.
Yeah.
And you had one logistical challenge.
I was going to ask you about that, but go ahead.
Yeah, I had a huge logistical challenge. Yeah, Julianne announced she was 3 months pregnant at the beginning of that film.
She was still at the end.
She was bigger. And she said to me, don't worry, my last pregnancy, it didn't show till 5 months. And this pregnancy was completely different. After about 3 months and one day, she started expanding on a daily basis.
Right. Didn't you stop shooting for a few weeks? At 9/11, didn't you? Or was that before you were
prepping?
During prep, okay.
But we were working in Bayonne, and the challenges of crossing rivers at that time made it very hard to work. But it was actually from the view from where we were working, which is an old Navy base, was dead on of the Twin Towers. So while we were downtown, the rest of the crew was in Bayonne watching the towers burn and us not being able to connect with them. And I always felt like that somehow informed the experience in some terrifyingly real, horrible way.
Yeah. And wasn't there some discussion about
the shape
of, because Eleanor wears the more pencil skirt silhouette.
The silhouette that Julianne has is slightly old-fashioned for where we were then.
Right.
I mean, it was a more conservative, more old-fashioned look,
right,
which is why at the end, her very last outfit is the straighter silhouette.
Right.
And that was about her sort of moving on to a new life and sort of getting rid of the old life and the old-fashioned
but
full
also
skirts.
Because it was wasted with
it
a full kind skirt,
of helped
it
a
kind
bit.
Of helped to
It kind
diminish.
Of helped. We just made the skirt bigger and bigger to try and I actually sort of let the dresses out as far as they could go, and every belt she had was on the sort of, by the end, was on the hanging on the very end.
And when you watch the performance, it's a brilliant sort of lexicon of subtle sort of Hawaiian gestures at the midsection of Julianne's part to just kind of deflect attention. I don't know if it actually draws more attention to the midsection as a result.
But she used to get bigger after lunch. I remember telling off her assistant when I saw her assistant carrying a piece of cake to her in the afternoon, saying, "Don't give her that. I'll get her back in that girdle after lunch."
But similarly, the way we conceived of the set, because it was the first time that I really was made it necessary to have a set built for such a huge part of this film, which was the house. And that, the way we, because I knew I wanted to emulate these high-low angles and these sort of places where characters would be looking down or up to each other and creating those kind of tensions, almost those little pools of conflict, especially in the party scene with Frank. And again, it was like constructing the shape to suit the dramatic needs of the film, which was an amazing opportunity that we had together.
Now, I imagine that on most films, the director and costume designer, production designer might not have to work so closely together every step of the way. It sort of feels with this one that no detail can happen without this like intense conversation with involving all of you. I mean, is that true? That like every little thing, because it seems like, I mean, every prop, every you know, it's so exquisitely detailed and meticulous. So it seems like you can't do anything with that.
But it's also not. Yeah. It's, you know, when you do reality, your life has got layers and layers and layers of what you have, the things behind the books, and in this case, the details were what we were seeing. They were particular. They were placed very, very self-consciously. Yeah. So they had to be considered. It wasn't, you know, they couldn't be a random thing just thrown there, because it was only one or two or three. So,
yeah. So
they all kind of, in a way, had to keep the story moving, but in another way, not necessarily be totally about where that character comes from all the time, which is what often is the case. You know, a lot of times with the setting, you are telling the story of that person up to that moment, the way they've lived, what's in their room, what's around them, and it wasn't so much in that way here. It was more about almost sometimes setting them apart from their own world, so that they almost didn't feel completely comfortable there.
Okay, let's open it up. So just raise your hand, and we'll bring the lights up a bit, and I'll repeat the questions right over here.
When I say first and foremost, I'm a big fan or admirer of your work.
Thank you.
That's okay, even in a museum, to say that, yeah.
It's hip. looking at Velvet Goldmine and the way you dealt with the male gaze in that film, and then you look at this film, is there, as the writer and director, is there ever a moment where you look at the Dennis Quaid character as you're developing him and you're like, oh man, you know, I did all this with that topic in this one film. Now, do you ever want to give him more than like, he's the victim of the heart wants what the heart wants and nothing more? Because I just felt like I really enjoyed this film, and this isn't a bad thing, but I'm just,
is there
ever a moment where you wanted to give him more, as opposed to like, he's the racist closet gay guy who just wants what he wants and he's going to get a divorce? Is there ever a moment where you wanted to give him more? Mm-hmm. More of a, because Velvet Goldmine is, I love that movie, and I've never seen a film like that in the past, in these times.
Yeah.
So I know it's a loaded question. I apologize.
Yeah. No. I don't know if people heard the question. It's about whether the character of Frank, the Dennis Quaid character in Far From Heaven, as opposed to the way gay identity is explored in Velvet Goldmine, if I ever wanted to give him more of a central role, I assume. And I didn't. I felt, from the very beginning, there was something about the domestic drama being so rooted in the female character that I was really interested to see how, although all three characters are complexly intertwined in this story, and I wanted it to have that kind of diagrammatic interdependency where each person, just in pursuing their desires, casts pain on the other in a tight web, you know, where events are acted upon the people. They don't, you know, they are kind of, no one, there's no villain, you know. People are just being human and trying to figure out their lives. But it ends up, you know, indicting and affecting and hurting the others around them. But I still felt that it was almost most interesting to see. It didn't take a liberationist position, this film. It was really about how we all have to sort of hold up the social, really what it's saying, I guess, is that the woman, although these three kinds of oppressions can be compared, that in a way the woman is on the bottom rung and has to maintain the dignity and the continuity of the family and that institution, and in a way has to surrender the most and give up the most. And ironically, in the 50s, a gay man who can hide, you know, who can disappear or make his desires selectively visible, has ultimately more freedom to maneuver, and that the black man who's so overly visible as black, you know, is overinterpreted, and Frank has hiding places that Raymond and Kathy don't. So, but I felt that I wanted to show that unique burden that the woman has, and the maybe extra burden of sacrifice that she has to show.
Could it just ask, there are two decisions that you made that are interesting in this regard. I think one, I think you said that you had thought about having a more explicit sex scene when she discovers Frank in the office kissing the man, but you had thought about maybe doing a more explicit sex scene, and decided not to. And that was interesting to me to read that. And then also, there's the only moment I think in the film when there's obscenity is when right. Frank says, you know, I just want to fucking get it over with.
Right.
And it's a powerful moment because it's the only time in the film.
Right.
And then her reaction to that
yeah.
is so, like, she's so shocked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was a matter of extremes, I guess. The whole thing was a matter of balancing. It's such a tightly wound generic tradition and specific story and kinds of characters, obviously. And even within the constraints of melodrama itself and adhering to the 50s traditions, these were also people who wouldn't be able to express themselves very freely. And for someone like Frank to undergo what he's undergoing is radical. And to even say fuck is radical, and to kiss a man is radical. So all of these things had measures of degree that kind of had to be balanced against others, I guess.
Yeah. Okay.
And they almost seemed stronger for the restraint.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you just go out and
totally.
Do it, you know, if you just go out and do it,
totally.
Then okay, you've done it.
Absolutely.
The fact that there was still sort of held,
yeah. know,
everything was kind of held, I think
definitely.
Makes it something that we can relate to rather
right.
than just telling it to us.
Yeah. And then, you know, Raymond kissing Kathy's hand, you know, becomes as strong a thing as Dennis kissing that guy, you know.
So in a way, everything is turned up to 11 except
right.
the people who are down around.
Right. yeah.
Okay. back here. Go ahead. So it well yeah if you transpose the story to a modern, you know, if it was set.
Have you seen Ali Farid's The Soul, the Fassbinder?
I haven't. I've been working on Raymond Fassbinder stuff. I
yet
to watch that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing to see because it's Fassbinder's remake of All That Heaven Allows, and he set it in contemporary Germany in a working class setting with a, you know, the Jane Wyman Rock Hudson story is about middle class older woman meets younger man gardener, and Fassbinder makes it a working an old, a much older, like 60 year old clean, you know, lavatory cleaner, whatever, mm-hmm. What's the word, female janitor, and a Moroccan Turkish Moroccan man, and black Turk, is he Turkish? He's, or is he Moroccan? I can't
yeah.
remember which. Anyway, and it's incredibly powerful. It still follows very strictly melodramatic conventions, but does modernize the setting.
It's the art gallery. The art gallery.
Over here?
What was it like working with the child actors who were really terrific? I mean, it was very hard to watch them, yes, sir, no, sir. I
What was it like working with the child actors? Yeah.
They were great kids. They were fantastic kids to work with. But what's tricky about this film, and it's sort of inherent in Cirque, is that children are often little monsters. They're also little emblems of patriarchal belief and oppressive feelings, right? So there's no real sentimentality for the kids. Even Mad Men shows so much more sympathy, I think, in the way kids are dealt with than Cirque does, and the way we tried to sort of follow that in that tradition here. So it's really tricky. Like, you see that moment with the son after you hear about Raymond's daughter getting hurt
And he's like, you know, he's like, Dad, it's, he's kind of excited about this horrible act of violence that occurred in school. And then he's like, you know, well, why don't you turn the TV set on, Skip, or whatever, you know, whatever he says. And he's like, sure, Dad, you know. And it's like, you've sensed this weird, you know, dismissal of the severity of that event that aligns the men with each other. And you see sort of a link in that, you know, you see, and you see the femininity and issues of how a woman is supposed to be also shared among mother and daughter in that early scene in the mirror as well.
Okay. Anybody else? Over here?
I guess the fact that you moved into television sort of answers this question.
Well, okay. Well, he said since you moved into television, but I guess by doing Mildred Pierce, but would it be hard to do a film like this now as a theatrical film? I mean,
the funny thing is that although we all knew we were taking tremendous risks by adhering this strictly and honoring so closely these you know, rigid conventions, narrative conventions, and that, let's face it, although noirs continue to be made, westerns continue to be made, genres associated with women, like domestic dramas, are sort of denigrated, and they're looked down upon. And male-associated dramas, I think, maintain a currency in contemporary culture in ways that female-driven, you know, where female audiences are associated, don't. It was a risk. It was a complete and total risk, and I consider it as much of an experiment as any of my other films. But yeah. What was so remarkable and surprising, I think, to everybody involved is that this became my crossover movie. This is the most successful, you know, movie that I've made in terms of critical acclaim, and that it really crossed over to a wider audience, and that it did, it made me feel so thrilled, not just about the film and all the great people I got to work with on it, but that this genre works and continues to both critique American culture and push you out enough to make you think about all those things, but then draw you back in emotionally at levels that you really feel. And I remember hearing the story about a woman who worked in the film business who had been meaning to see Far From Heaven, didn't get around to it, had a screener, finally watched the screener, had a three-year-old child who was sleeping on her lap when she finally got around to watching Far From Heaven. And she figured the kid would go to sleep. And she was watching Far From Heaven, and she gets to the end of the movie, and she looks down, and her kid is crying. And she said, honey, what's the matter? And the little kid said, Mommy, how come that nice man can't be with that nice lady? And I was like, damn, man, that is so cool. Like, you know, that this could be a movie that, you know, the punk kid out of, like, you know, critical studies college with tattoos would take her grandma to. And they could both enjoy the experience equally, but with that very different, you know, reasons, you know.
But to make it today, Frank would have to be a cyborg double agent.
Well, there's that. It was. It is 10 years old. A lot, I guess, things have really.
But she'd probably be able to make it on HBO. I mean, that's
probably
the irony.
Be able to make it on HBO. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, right over here.
Get used to it.
It feels quite
high. Can I go first?
Yeah, please.
So I bought my son a used Nikon FM2 camera because he wanted a film camera. And I only shot film cameras from when I was 5 until, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago when I forgot they existed. And we shot some pictures and we printed them, and they were beautiful. They're so beautiful. There's grain and things and
developed.
We went to the lab that's left, that one in Chelsea. So I don't know. That's how I grew up. He pulled out some vinyl, scratched the needle across, and heard bass again, and it was beautiful. But it's on the other hand, you can shoot at night without lights now. It's it's the world we live in. So.
And always cheaper.
And depth of Yeah. Well, even we saw it on HD television last night, and it was a whole other thing. I mean, the difference is on a film print. I think there's a little more control too about what you see in a film print when it's finally been timed, and once things are sort of out in the digital world, that they're on a phone and on a screen and this all that coming from the same file. So, that part of it is going to be harder to hold on to, that kind of control.
Yeah, it just felt starkly different to me. I mean, I enjoyed it tremendously, but it didn't feel like I was watching the same film. What's your feeling about that? I mean, there's nothing to be done. We're going digital regardless, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, it took an adjusting when I first came in. We just came in for the end, Sandy and I, and it looked... I mean, there was still some grain that I could see in the HD, but it's not the same at all. I'm just still happy people are still shooting on film. I mean, I've yet to shoot on digital, a digital camera. And it's not... in every case, it's been... because I just felt the film camera, whatever, if it was even 16, we shot Mildred Pierce purposefully on 16mm so that it would accrue grain, because even the high-speed lenses today and the fast stocks make, when you transfer to HDTV, which I knew it would end up on HDTV, you lose the grain. It's so electric, you know. So we went the other direction, and it actually saved a little money in it, and it restored grain, and it gave it some real texture, which is beautiful.
It looked good on the screen.
Did. Oh yeah, I know, and it really holds up. It's beautiful on the screen. But yeah, people still shoot film. They shoot film. You know, they shoot TV shows on film still.
I'm sure. Also, when color film started coming out, these kinds of conversations were going on.
Yeah.
So I think it's something we'll get used to.
It would be better to have a good film print. I mean, the reality is the studios don't have them. You know, so we asked, actually. I actually agree with you. You know, I think as good as this looks, and it looks fantastic, it would look better on a good print, but that print doesn't. They could own one, in which case they'll keep it in their archive. So there's a few archival prints scattered around, possibly. But it is it's sort of what Mark said, to get used to it, you know. So there's.
But you can also take an SLR out now and make your own film. So,
I agree, especially when a film is this exquisitely photographed. You know, you want to see it like the way that you're imagining it, or the way that you remember seeing it the first time.
Yeah.
So that would be ideal. Yeah. Go ahead. Oh, right over here. You haven't gone yet.
It seems like it's a giant leap backwards. They've almost tried to destroy the look that you put in the film. I don't accept the inevitability argument. You guys have the position to actually speak more about that. Could you comment on what's going on? Starting from... It seems like shooting on film, you're still doing it. They take a print and... basically destroy it if they can. Project it. It's the elephant in the room. Nobody says a word. People say life goes on. I don't understand why we're going backwards.
It's a comment just more about
that brought the room
what
down.
The trade-off and the loss of what?
That sort of brought things down to a depressing
sort of
level.
Downer, man.
No, I agree. I agree. You know, the studios, Fox was the first studio to announce that they'll, after this year, they will not make film prints. I mean, if a film comes out from Fox or Fox Searchlight, it's not film. And, by the end of 2013, no new movies will be made in film. You know, there won't be film.
There's very few labs left.
I'm sorry?
There's very few places you can actually process film left.
Right. So so for us, you know, this is a whole history of film that where we want to keep showing film prints, but we are at a point, you know, where there won't be film, you know, film, there won't be films on, made on film any, like in the very, very near future. I don't know, it's Noah. I mean, what's happening with Noah? Won't be released on
shooting on film.
Shooting on film, but will be released.
Released on iPhone.
iPhone scope.
Okay, so back there, we could talk about the film. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I guess if you could talk about casting some of the extras, some of the background atmosphere in the film.
It was along the same kind of criteria Mark was talking about in terms of how to set, dress sets where, you know, we worked with great cast, extras casting in, out of New York, and they were all like, well, Hartford, Connecticut in 1957 had a large population of Italian Americans, and so these are the kind of faces that we're suggesting. And I said, no, sorry, we want everybody to look like there in, from Central Casting in the back lot at Universal Studios in 1957. So we reverted to these all, basically a lot of these extras were, you could tell they were ex-models, you know, but gray, with gray silver tipped hair, because they were all very patrician and very tall and sort of perfect looking. And they kind of needed to move badly, you know, and Tim Bird, our AD, who directs, the AD traditionally directs extras, got a real, again, he worked completely out of his normal, the normal naturalistic language and tradition of trying to make extras look real, which actually is a really, and often failed. they're often from another planet, the extras in movies, no matter how real they're supposed to try to be. He got, had the fun of trying to make them look unreal and stiff, you know. And so, it, again, it was just counterintuitive to the way we usually, you know, operate in production. But it was fun, and it just made you think about, because it's all artificial. Film is artificial, you know, and this is a celebration and a complicated, I think, elevation of how the artificial and the authentic, in terms of emotion, interplay. And somehow, sometimes when you don't try to imitate reality, something even more real happens, because it's allowing something that, it's always about translating.
In a way, it's almost more honest.
It's almost more honest. You're not lying. You're being honest. And so, and a viewer always has to do something to make this real for them. And in a weird way, the more you cater to that, the less you're sort of using what is innate to our abilities as spectators, to wait, to fill in, to, you know, think around, to both think and feel at the same time, I guess, is what some, you know, has been the goal of some artists and creators. So it's a, just a, it's, and that's just more true for melodrama than other generic traditions, and it's just one that I continue to you know, go back to in my mind. I just find it to be so interesting, complicated.
I do want to ask Sandy, like, in relation to this idea, like, what your research was or what your references were, because was it all, you know, the movie 1950s instead of the real 1950s?
I was just, as Todd was saying just then about the idea was to make it not look real. I look at that again, and I think, my God, it looks really authentic. It looks really authentically like a 50s film.
Right.
Rather, it,
right.
Looks, it right. Really looks real like a... So, in answer to that question, yeah, I did look at a lot of films. I looked at people dressed in films of the period. I did look at things like Sears catalogues and fashion from the period as well, but really the main inspiration came from how people looked in films as opposed to how people really looked on the street.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is that I remember getting so many reactions from people when we showed Far From Heaven, would come up to me and say, that's exactly what it was like in the 50s. That's my life.
Wow.
And you realize how much, you know, popular culture, film, mediate our lives and our, and maybe it, sometimes in history more than others, you know.
Yeah.
And certainly the 50s you know, one would imagine that would be maybe more true during that period. But I love that, and how memory is even, you know, affected by popular images. And
okay, we'll just take one more. So right over here. Go ahead.
Thank you.
That's right. Todd, were you wearing
look,
green
he's doing it now. Well, at least the hair.
Oh, what, velvet gold mine
hair. Yeah, velvet gold mine. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I'm reverting.
Yeah.
Actually, well, it depends on the film, but yeah, you do find yourself. Yes, you do. I mean, I didn't necessarily in Far From Heaven. I'm sure there would have been some element of it that I did adopt, but you can't help it. You either get drawn in by the color or the texture, and definitely the shapes. And quite often, I do end up if I'm depending on what it is, I ended up. Actually, I had these made last year when I was doing Hugo from the tailor that was building clothes for Ben Kingsley, believe it or not. But I mean, sort of a little bit 1930s. But you can't help getting inspired by it and influenced.
Do you do that with Noah? Are you dressing Old Testament these days? Yeah.
No, but you did. Didn't you take most of the furniture home with you?
I did.
Oh, yes, right.
I brought home Mark's clothes.
Really?
I did. They dressed my house. Yeah, I've been living in Far From Heaven ever since, in Portland. In my, I just recently put on eBay the diagonal couch.
Is it still
really?
Up? Is it still up?
No.
But
no,
you put it on,
right,
I'm sorry.
Right away.
You put it on eBay?
Did you say as seen in?
I did. We finally did. Well, no, we didn't advertise it that way, but we just told them after they bought it as a little bonus.
I know. But I was reading an article about the film, and people were putting things on eBay, describing them as Far From Heaven style.
Right.
I mean, and they weren't from the movie, but it just became sort of
before something else followed in popular culture.
That's right, yeah.
Yes. Usurped.
That's right, right. All those descriptions were changed.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I hope you all come back with iPhones to show us your next films. But thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.